So picking up from last week, Louisa said, after I came round from that state, I felt such pains, such annihilation of myself, a kind of annihilation is kind of undoing, that I saw myself as a miserable little worm that was able to do nothing but crawl on the earth. And I said, Lord, help, your omnipotence knocks me down. I see that if you do not lift me, my nothing will undo and be dissolved. Put beside that John 15:5, without me you can do nothing, Jesus said. So give me suffering, Louisa said, but I beg you to give me strength, for I feel I am dying. Now notice, can't do it by myself, but I can do it with you. That's Philippians 4:13. So after an alternation began of visits between the Lord and torments on the part of demons, the more I resigned myself, the more they increased their rage. Very interesting. 1 Peter 5:8. If you bow before the power of God, the demons will flee. Now, why will the demons not want what Louisa is doing? Because it's going to have an unbelievable impact on human history. And they can do nothing but rage. They don't have the power to actually touch her. So a few days after what I said above, I felt like I was losing consciousness again. She will never admit to falling into ecstasy. She only says, I lost consciousness. I remember at the beginning, every time I felt such a state, I thought I was going to leave life initially. As I lost consciousness, our Lord made himself seen once again with the crown of thorns on his head, all dripping with blood. And turning to me, he said, daughter, take a look at what men do to me. In these sad times, their pride is so great that they have poisoned all the air. Now, I want you to put Genesis 6:5-6. Because there you'll find God's comment before the first great cleansing of the earth. Genesis 6:5-6. Where God said that their hearts fashion nothing but evil all day long. Now, Jesus here says that before the turn of the 20th century, that the sins of the human race had poisoned the air. We now know at the beginning of the 21st century that we have poisoned the sea as well as the air. And we've poisoned the earth as well. And the stench that spreads everywhere is such that it has reached even before my throne in heaven. And that's exactly what you read in Genesis 6 as well, that the stench of this sin has reached me in heaven. They act in such a way as to close heaven by themselves. Because you have to put beside that Hebrews 12:14. Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can ever enter the presence of God. So if they're wallowing in pride, well, pride is the greatest sin. It's the first sin. It's the first of the deadly sins. It's the sin that identifies Satan. And it's the sin that threw Satan out of heaven, because pride can't exist in heaven. So if pride is the big thing on earth, it means we're fit for hell. That's what he means by closing heaven. Now, if you remember the Magnificat of Blessed Mother in Luke chapter 1, verse 70, she says that God resists the proud. She pulls down the proud from the mighty ones from their thrones and raises up the lowly. In that text I gave you in 1 Peter 5:8, Peter says that God resists the proud and he favours the humble. And you'll find that all over the Psalms and the Proverbs and everywhere. So just give you those two. The miserable ones now are the ones with the pride and the rebellion against God, do not have eyes to know the truth, because pride will blind the eyes, because they are obfuscated by the sin of pride. We would simply say blinded. Followed by the other vices that they bring with them, because pride never comes alone. It's pride, covetousness, lust, anger, gluttony, and all the rest. Oh, please, he said, give me a relief. Now, if you and I said to each other, give me a relief, I might be doing something and you decide I'll take the machine and do it for a while. And there, that's the relief. But you have to know in these writings that a relief means that Louisa will make reparation and give Jesus souls. Souls will be saved. That's the relief. And so don't misunderstand that now in very human terms. So please give me a relief from so many bitter spasms and a reparation for so many wrongdoings against me. And in saying this, he removed the crown from himself, which did not look like a crown, but all one piece. This is very interesting. Louisa says, we depict Jesus as wearing a circle on his head. And the saints say that is not so, that the crown of thorns was entirely over his head like a cap, because what they took was a thorn bush and clamped it down on him. So it was right down to his neck and penetrating the brain and the neck and the ears and the eyes and the mouth. It's unbelievable what the crown of thorns was like. So when artists have depicted the crown of thorns, it's just a little simple ring. It's because they can't look at the reality. The reality was terrible. It was all one piece, such that not even a little portion of the head remained free. It was all pierced through with those thorns. And as he removed the crown, he drew near me and asked if I accepted it. I felt so annihilated. I felt such pains because of the offences that are given that I felt my heart split. We say our heart breaks, but what's the difference? I said to him, Lord, do with me what you want. And so he took it and he drove it into my head. Now notice, drove it in. That's to make sure that it would really go in. It's not all that unusual that a person in a deep relationship with Jesus would be asked to take one thorn. Remember Rose of Lima? Or the crown of thorns? Or to carry at least part of the wound on the shoulder? Or other aspects of the passion? Because each one of us has our own specific place in the passion. Because otherwise you're not one of his members. Like if I'm crucified, this hand participates because it's part of me. So if I'm part of the body of Christ, I have to participate. So suffering and the cross, if it's not there, the authentic sign of Christianity is not there. People just don't realise that. The ones who think they can go to heaven on cushions are all wrong. So it's not unusual for people. But the thing that is unusual is the severity of what Louisa experiences and the frequency with which she is asked to do it. That's the difference. And notice he asked her if she would accept it, because God will never, ever violate your free will. He's the only one who won't. Others will. So he drove it into my head. Beside that, I want you to put Galatians 6:17. It's about participating in the passion. Galatians 6:17. So I'll give you a heading for the next paragraph. It's all about the crown of thorns. Sometimes I can give you headings, and I think it helps when you go to read it. Now, who can tell the spasms I felt when I came back to myself? Now, notice, this was given to her in this ecstatic state. And while she's in the ecstatic state, she's very specially helped. But when she comes back into her normal state, the sheer awesomeness of what she said yes to comes to her. That's what she means by I came back to myself. So she comes out of the ecstasy. At each movement of my head, I thought I would breathe my last. That's a very favourite expression of hers. So many were the pains and the prickings I felt in my head, in my eyes, in my ears, behind my neck. Now, the word prickings is going to be picked up in these writings, and you'll hear it from different angles. And the Lord will tell you, I think we had it in volume 14 only last week. He said, the ordinary itsy bitsies of irritations and things that go against you in your everyday life, you should think of them as the prickings of the crown of thorns. And it's the way you look at them that makes all the difference as to how you can respond to them. So instead of going mad and thinking everybody's against you, you know what I mean? Looking at them as a participation in the passion actually makes you respond with humility and patience and love in a way you wouldn't think of otherwise. So it's the way you look at things. Now, I'm pointing these words out to you because I've read so much of this stuff and to show you how a word will be picked up and elaborated on later on. I felt those thorns penetrate even into my mouth. If you're doing the hours of the Passion, she explains that that happened to Jesus. And it clenched in such a way that I could not open it to take food. So I would remain sometimes 2 days, sometimes three, without being able to take anything. When they somehow mitigated, I would feel sensibly a hand which pressed my head and renewed the pains. So the Lord renews it for her. The bit that's unusual is the renewal and the frequency and the sheer depth of the pain. Sometimes the spasms were such that I would lose consciousness because of the pain. Now, that is an ordinary phenomenon. There are people in the New Age movement and in the occult who want out-of-the-body experiences. And if you want an out-of-the-body experience by your own efforts, then you've got to put the body under some kind of extreme pressure. And they do that, and they do have their astral projections and all the rest of it and all the rest of it. But in the past, when they put criminals into a straitjacket, the effect of the suffocation of the straitjacket was such that many of them had out-of-the-body experiences just to survive. That's the sheer pressure. So, and the only reason why I'm giving you that example is to indicate that the pressure can do it. But of course, these people who are doing this by themselves are not having an authentic religious experience. So notice the hand that pressed on her again and renewed the thing. And then she would lose consciousness because of the pain. Now, the body losing consciousness because of the pain is the body trying to survive. It happens with sick people as well. At the beginning, this would happen on certain days, while on others it wouldn't. When they were repeated, it would be 3 or 4 times a day. Now, that's the bit that's very unusual. And they would last sometimes a quarter of an hour, sometimes half an hour, sometimes 1 hour. And then I would remain free, though feeling very weak and in suffering. I would remain in suffering more or less, depending on how much those pains were communicated to me during the state of dozing. Now, that's the other language she uses for going into this ecstatic state. She will not acknowledge that it is ecstasy. The experience that I have just described would make the vast majority of people become extremely depressed. Would you understand that? Yeah. Particularly when it goes on and on and on. You could endure it once or every now and then. But 4 times a day and going on for days, I mean, this is totally unusual. And her courage in accepting this experience is totally amazing. And she never wavers, she never becomes depressed, she never says enough, she never says no. She's an amazing lady. I also remember that since sometimes I could not open my mouth in order to take food, as I said above, because of the sufferings of my head, and since my family knew that I didn't really want to be in company, when they saw that I was not eating, they would attribute it to a fuss of mine. Now, I think that's an understatement. If I was the parent of a teenager spending most of her time in her room, and then she won't even eat, not only will she not communicate with anybody else, but now she's not eating either, wouldn't you think that the parent would start getting fiercely worried? Yeah, well, they did. And she calls it a persecution from her parents, which a teenager would do, of course. So, and the parents calling it a fuss of mine is just her way of passing it off. And naturally they would become irritated, of course, and they would get upset and they would mock me. It's very interesting. My nature, watch this now, this is very carefully put. My nature wanted to resent this, because I saw that what they were saying was not true, but the Lord didn't want the resentment. Now, that's very, very important. And the reason is that if you go to the book of Sirach, chapter 27, there's a wonderful piece there on resentment. And it starts off by saying, resentment is a foul thing and you find this with sinners. Ta-da. But human nature is quite quick in producing this particular sin, because we feel irritated that somebody has violated our rights or our space or our whatever it is that we don't want violated. And we can resent it very quickly. And so Louisa very quickly learns that human nature wants to give this response, but the divine will wants something completely different. And the extraordinary thing about her is that she can see it. The rest of us have fallen into resentment before. You say, oh my God, I have to get out of here. I shouldn't be here. But you might have slipped into it without even thinking about it. She's completely different. She's able to see it. And therefore she can make very good decisions. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 13:5 there as well. That love doesn't resent. And she said, and this is what happened. One evening while we were at table, now she's eating with the family because she's not yet confined to bed, and I was in this state of not being able to open my mouth, my family began to get upset. Now, to explain this poor family, she has not yet told them what's going on. She's not told them about her relationship with God. She's not told them about the extraordinary grace she's receiving. And the poor family only know that they have a daughter who is not communicating with anyone and wants to be by herself. And now she's not eating as well. If they didn't get upset, they wouldn't be parents, would they? So Louisa said, I was so affected that I started to cry. And in order not to be seen, I got up to go somewhere else, still crying. And I prayed Jesus Christ. Now, she rarely refers to Jesus as Jesus Christ, rarely. And the Most Holy Virgin to give me help and strength in order to bear this trial. But as I was doing this, I felt I was beginning to lose consciousness. In other words, the Lord begins to let the family see that there's something extraordinary happening in this person's life. So she falls into ecstasy in front of them. Okay. Oh God, what pain at the mere thought that my family was going to see me, for until then they had not noticed. I would imagine they'd noticed more than she thought. At that moment I said, Lord, do not allow them to see me. I was so ashamed of being seen that I myself, ashamed I think is not what you would say, I was so scared that they would see me and all the consequences of them finding out, that I myself cannot explain why. I tried as much as I could to hide myself in those places where I wouldn't be seen. But then I was caught by surprise. In other words, the Lord didn't give her a choice. In such a way, I would not have the time to hide or even at least to kneel. For whatever position I was in, I would remain in it and they might say that I was praying. Now, you notice that if you've watched any of the films to do with the children of Garabandal, that as soon as they went into ecstasy, it was wherever they saw Blessed Mother, whether they were outdoors, indoors, whether they were going uphill or downhill, and they came downhill backways and did all kinds of extraordinary things that you couldn't do outside of an ecstasy. And this is the first time the family begin to realise that there's something major going on here. And she hadn't told them. How she got this far without telling anybody amazes me completely. So I lost consciousness. She went into ecstasy. Our Lord made himself seen in the midst of many enemies who gave him all sorts of insults. Especially they grabbed him and trampled him underfoot. They blasphemed against him and they pulled his hair. Now, that's the kind of stuff she describes that Jesus experienced in the house of Caiaphas and in Herod's palace, this kind of treatment. It seemed to me that my good Jesus wanted to escape from under those fetid souls, and he kept looking. Who knows, he might find a friendly hand who would free him. That, of course, was Louisa. But he found no one. While seeing this, I did nothing but cry over the pains of my Lord. First of all, she was crying for fear her family would find out what was going on, and now she's crying over the Lord's pains, which is better. I would have wanted to go into the midst of those enemies. Who knows, maybe I could free him. But I didn't dare to. I said to him, Lord, let me share in your pains. Please, if only I could relieve you and free you. As I was saying this, those enemies, as if they had understood, came against me, but so enraged. And they began to beat me, to pull my hair and to trample me. I had so much fear. I suffered, yes, but within me I was content. Now, here is the combination that you will find when a person is suffering because the Lord has allowed it in order to make reparation for others. As I was saying, here we come across something that's very authentic in the spiritual life, and you find it with other mystics and victim souls as well. that they will suffer either part of the passion or whatever. But while they have these sufferings, they also have this extraordinary peace inside. And the combination of suffering and joy is something that we don't put together. If someone brings suffering on themselves, it's a totally different thing altogether. All you have is the pain. You don't have anything else. But what they have is a joy that cannot be explained on the earth. Because if you're suffering deeply, most people don't have the joy. Now, Louisa calls it contentment. And beside that, I want you to put Hebrews 12:2. Hebrews 12:2. And Hebrews 12:2 says that for the joy that was put before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame of it. It doesn't mean that you don't feel the pain, but it means that your concentration is on something else. And the something else is that this pain is, I'm going to use language from the higher books, this pain is divine currency for saving souls. And when they when the person realizes that it becomes real treasure, that they can save souls from hell, then they will put up with the pain and they will not consider it a problem. So she said, within me I was content because I could see that the Lord was given a little respite. The respite is that souls are saved. Afterwards, those enemies disappeared and I remained alone with Jesus. I tried to sympathize with him, but I didn't dare to say anything. And he, breaking the silence, said to me, all that you have seen is nothing compared to the offenses that they give me continuously. Now, all that she has been shown so far in terms of what's going on the planet. Their blindness. Now, the blindness comes from pride, but it also comes from aberrant sexual sin. It's very, very blinding. And St. Paul will explain that in Romans chapter 1 for you, if you want it. Their blindness, after flooding themselves with the things of the earth, is such that they reach a point of becoming not only my cruel enemies, but also enemies of themselves. And since their eyes are fixed on mud, they reach the point of despising the eternal. Now, that's happening all around us. Beside that, I have Philippians 3:18. Despising the eternal, you know that in the occult, they call Satan the strong one and Jesus the weak one. And they don't refer to Jesus by name. They simply refer to him as the weak one. And the official title they give to Satan is the strong man. I'm sure you've heard the strong man, have you? Yeah, and then Jesus is the weak one. Have you heard that before? Oh dear. It's important to understand this kind of background. Then you will understand that when Jesus says despising the eternal, it's actually literally true. It's actually literally true. Because they do despise the Lord as being the weak one. And the weak one because he allowed himself to be taken and scourged and crucified and all the rest of it. And only a fool would allow that. The strong one would dominate and conquer his enemies and all the rest of it. And you see, even the apostles were affected with that kind of thinking. Probably the rest of us as well. So, who will put amend to such ingratitude? Throughout the 36 volumes, the human race is identified as the ungrateful ones. Who will have compassion for so many people who cost me blood and who live almost buried in the stench of earthly things? Now, the stench of earthly things is usually simply called mud. Oh, please come with me and pray and cry together with me for so many blind people understood. You need to put the word people in there, who are all eyes for all that gives of the earth, and then despise and trample my graces under their filthy feet as if it were mud. So Matthew 7:6 there. Oh, please lift yourself above all that is of the earth. Abhor and despise all that does not belong to me. What he's saying is detach yourself from the earth so that you will be able to truly be in my presence and I can really genuinely use you to save souls. But if some of the mud has stuck to you, you're not very useful. Do not be affected anymore by the insults you receive from your family. That's a tall one, isn't it? Because your feelings won't change. After you have seen me suffer so much. Now, what he does is he gives her motivation to endure. That's the important thing. Rather, take to heart only my honour. And take to heart the offences that they give me continuously. The loss of so many souls. Now, you must take to heart the Lord's honour. Beside that, I want you to put 1 Samuel 2:30. 1 Samuel 2:30. Where the Lord says, those who honour me, I will honour. 1 Samuel 2:30. Oh, please do not leave me alone in the midst of so many pains and torture that torture my heart. All that you are suffering now is little compared to the pains that you will suffer. So he always warns you ahead of time. Have I not always told you that what I want from you is the imitation of my life, that Louisa is to be a perfect image of Jesus? Therefore, she has to have his mission of saving souls. She has to have the reaction of the world. She has to suffer all the rejection that he was given and all the rest of it. Take a look at how dissimilar you are from me, and therefore pluck up courage and do not fear. And the reason for the similarity was that Louisa was to be a major player in the 20th century to save the human race from destroying itself. So then she says, after this I returned to myself, and then I realized that I was surrounded by my family. Of course, when you're in ecstasy, you don't know anything outside of yourself. You only know what's going on inside. They were crying and they were all troubled. In other words, they didn't know what on earth was going on. And they were so concerned that state might occur again, and especially that I might die, that they brought me back to Corato. In other words, she was still on the family farm, and they brought her back to Corato permanently, as quickly as they could, so that I might be observed by doctors. Now, here's her horror. And here's the next layer of suffering. The amazing thing is, she'll take the crown of thorns anytime, or the cross. Don't give me doctors, and don't give me family reacting. But a lot of us are like that, aren't we? We just don't like the complications of that human beings give us. That many times, Louisa said, I cried and lamented to the Lord, saying to him, how many times, Lord, I begged you to let me suffer hiddenly. This was my only and sole contentment, and now I am deprived also of this. She doesn't realise that sufferings are sufferings, and she has a fixation in her head that suffering means the crown of thorns, carrying the cross, being crucified or whatever. But it doesn't involve the family, and it doesn't involve the priests, and it doesn't involve others. The thing is, if you are able to take sufferings, that's not your cross. Your cross consists of the sufferings that you don't want. A definition of your cross is something that you would give to anybody, anytime, anywhere, no conditions asked. Just take it. And if there's anything causing you that level of disturbance or challenge in your life, it's your cross. And it can be anything. It could be something outside of you. It could be inside of you. It could be in the family. It could be anything. But it's always something which is the last thing on the planet you wanted to happen to you. And think about it. Some people don't even know what their cross is. And I can tell you, even up to volume 14, Louisa will not acknowledge what is her big cross. It's fascinating. It's the deprivation of Jesus. In these early days, before she really goes into that, it's the family making a fuss and all the rest of it. And these are only little crosses, but her big one is the deprivation. She said, now, what are we going to do now? Tell me, how shall I endure this? You alone can help me and relieve me from my affliction. Don't you know how many things they say? Now, he's going to tell her to put on your deaf ear. You know you have a deaf ear you can switch on, don't you? If you don't, then anybody in your family can teach you. Have you ever said something to a person and you could say it three times and they haven't heard it? They've switched on their deaf ear. Other people switch on hearing aids to try and hear. But the vast majority of people have this very special selective hearing process. You've met it, haven't you? Ah, yeah, of course you have. We all do it as well. I mean, how often will you have to study this material before it registers what you've heard? She says, one thinks one way and one another. One wants to apply this remedy to me and another one. And they're all eyes over me in such a way as they give me no peace. Oh, please help me in so many pains, for I feel life failing me. Her inner instinct is for solitude. Solitude means being alone with the alone. That's why she spends so much time in her room, because she's praying all the time. Okay, so to have all this fuss and everything going around her and doctors coming and all the rest of it for her is absolute horror. So what does she need? She needs a little bit of teaching on how to deal with human beings. Would you think that? That's your heading for the next paragraph. How to deal when human beings interfere. Now, in these writings, the words human beings are not used. They say creatures. I hate the word. But they say creatures all the time. So how to deal with creatures when they interfere. We could all do a few lessons on that, couldn't we? So the Lord came and very kindly, the word is benignly in my book, but we say kindly, he added, do not want to afflict yourself because of this. Now, the expression is awkward in English, but terribly important. The thing is, she's afflicted anyway, but he said, don't put your will into it. Don't want it. And so in these early volumes, Jesus makes it very clear, okay, your nature wants to resent something. Don't put your will into it, because if you put your will into it, it's sin. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And he said, don't want to wallow in this thing. Because in other words, to use our language, don't go into a self-pity party. You understand that language, don't you? Yeah. And that's why I try to use language that we use, so you'll actually get it. So Jesus said, don't put your will into it. What I want, that's divine will, from you, is that you abandon yourself in my arms as if you were dead. Now, someone who's dead is not going to react, are they? If you ever succeed in doing this, you'll be canonized, of course. But beside it, I want you to put Psalm 131. Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. Now, a weaned child on its mother's lap is sleeping or awake very peacefully. They're not worried about the latest news. They're not worried about Brexit. They're not worried about the Third World War or who's paying the mortgage or who's bringing in the food or who's getting the dinner. They're not worried about anything. So they're completely and totally in a relaxed position. That's why that psalm is actually terribly important. So Jesus is saying to Louisa, is there any possibility that you could just relax in my arms and let me be God? Oh, but we human beings find it very difficult to let God be God, because we're running the human race and we're running the earth. And anyway, we know best. You don't have children who know better than their parents, do you? Nowadays, children educate the parents. So it's very difficult for us to actually relax into God's presence. It's called surrendering to the divine will. You see, I use the ordinary language and then I'll give you the official language called surrendering to the divine will. Until you keep your eyes opened to look at what I am doing and at what the creatures say and do, I cannot operate in you freely. Now, he says, if you have one eye on me and one eye on what everybody else is doing, then you have not sufficient amount of attention for either to deal with one or the other. And he says, in your particular case, because he's going to put Louisa isolated in a bed for 64 years to do the work that she has to do. So in her particular case, he said, look, leave that. I'll deal with it. I want you surrendered to me. Actually, for her, it's harder than the crown of thorns, I think. Isn't it difficult for us to surrender to people around you giving their own reactions and you're not allowed to give yours? Oh, yeah, it's difficult. He said, don't you want to trust me? Because the basis of all true relationship is trust, isn't it? Don't you know how much I love you and that everything I allow, either through creatures, that's family and doctors and blah, 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 or from demons, or directly from me, is truly for your good. Now, if you could take out that out of the book and write it on something that you could read it separately from the whole thing, it's amazing that if we could accept that no matter what happens to us, good, bad or indifferent, that God has allowed it for our good. Psalm 145, verse 17. Psalm 145, verse 17. And it says, God only ever acts out of love. This is one of the great secrets of becoming a saint quickly, is that no matter what happens, we say, the Lord has permitted that and he's permitted it for my good. Oh, but we find it so hard, don't we? The other one I want to give you for that is Romans 8:25. That's truly for your good. And it serves for nothing but to lead the soul to that state for which I have chosen her. In other words, the irritations of our everyday life, the small difficulties that we have coming from our own selves or from other people or from things that happen or don't happen or as it may be, all of them are the stitches that go into the garment of redemption for you. Therefore, I want you to remain in my arms with your eyes closed. That means you don't give your attention to that. Without looking at or investigating this or that. Oh, we find that very difficult. We like rationalizing everything, don't we? And, you know, the child in school comes home and the teacher has corrected them. The teacher has it in for me. It's just that I had a very special dad and he used to say, and what did you do for the teacher to have it in for you? He kind of knew that the problem didn't start with the teacher. So we learned not to tell him. And then we'd say, how did you get on? He'd go, oh, great. For fear we'd get more correction at home, you know. So trusting me completely and letting me operate freely. Now, if we could do those few sentences, we would be saints in no time. If then you want to do the opposite, now the working it all out and analysing it and deciding what you're going to do regardless of anybody else is the thing that keeps us adults back. If you want to do the opposite, you'll lose much time and you'll come to oppose what I want to do in you. As for creatures, watch this now. Please write this up in some big notebook, 1 foot deep. Use profound silence. Wow. We're told that the measure of wisdom is knowing when not to open your mouth. And some people can't even wait for you to finish the sentence and they're in with their 2 feet. And they do terrible damage. With regard to creatures, use profound silence. That's number one. Be kind, number two. Oh, boys, number three is be submissive to everyone. Now, the being submissive to everyone fitted Louisa's situation perfectly. It mightn't fit yours because you might be the head of a family. You might be the one guiding others. So you can't submit to the children you're training. Does that make sense? If you're the teacher in the class, you can't submit to the pupils because you're supposed to be running it. If you're the doctor, you can't submit to the patient. So you have to be very careful. He's talking about Louisa's own very special circumstances in which she's going to live an absolutely extraordinary life confined to a bed. The biggest problem you have in volume one is sorting out what's for Louisa and what's for us. Once you've done that in volume one, you're okay. You can fly. And so let your life, your breathing, your thoughts, your affections be continuous acts of reparations. Now, we can all do that. To to placate my justice, offering me along with them the bothers from creatures. I love the expression. They're simply bothering you, you know. Which will not be few, because human beings, everyone you meet, have their own opinion, their own way of looking at things, their own way of deciding, their own way of doing things. And if you're dealing with a whole lot of them, as Louisa will be dealing with a whole lot of people, they'll all have different views. You know the expression we use today, that doctors differ and patients die. In other words, ask 10 doctors and you'll die. Ask one of them and you might live. After this, she said, I did as much as I could to resign myself to the will of God, although many times I was put to such constraints by the creatures. Now, the creatures are her family. The doctors and anybody else coming in, the housekeeper, friends and relatives, that at times I would do nothing but cry. That's why I'm explaining the creatures there, in case you think it's some kind of amorphous thing out there on planet Earth. She had names for them all. And the thing is, the people who annoy us and challenge us, we have names for them all as well, every one of them. And one of the things, if only we would call them God's little helpers, we'd get on better. Instead of calling them enemies or people opposing us or whatever, God's little helpers. They're at least trying to make me humble, if nothing else. So Louisa's still very young here in volume one, hence she cries easily. But crying easily is actually a very healthy thing. God gave you tear ducts to help you to cry. And the crying within reason actually relieves the emotional life. We've done terrible things in the 20th and 21st century. For example, we tell little boys, you mustn't cry, you're a boy. And so what does he do? He locks all his emotions inside. He can't deal with them. And then when it comes to the time when he must deal with it, they'll come out maybe as violence or whatever. It's our fault. A child has to be able to cry. And one of the things I find fascinating, if you read both Louisa's Passion and also Maria Valtorta's works, is that Jesus cried easily. And if you just watch out for it now in the hours of the Passion, the number of times Louisa said he was crying. But we have this funny thing that it's not manly to cry. But the point is that if you're in a situation where crying is the correct response and you don't do it, then you become ill. I always make a plea for crying because we've gone to such a terror. We even say to people, oh, don't cry. I say, do cry if you need to cry. I mean, if someone in your family has died and you don't cry, but what on earth is wrong? And if you swallow that up, then what do? You end up in a hospital sick. And it's simply because the body has not been allowed to express what the person is experiencing. Is that okay? I want to make that plea so that we don't behave like silly adults. And Louisa cries quite a bit, actually, in the first, the early volumes. So then she says, the time came for me to be visited by a doctor. So this is horror and shock, you know. And he judged that it was nothing other than a nervous phenomenon. In other words, all in your head. That's exactly what you need to hear. Nowadays, they say it's psychosomatic. That still means all in your head, that you're cooking it up yourself. They don't realise that whatever is going on inside of you is expressed in the body. That was the way you were created. If it's not psychosomatic, it's nothing. I mean, the headache tells you there's something wrong, doesn't it? So watch this. It was a nervous phenomenon, so it's, you know, psychosomatic. So he prescribed medicines, distractions, my goodness, strolls, cold baths. Well, I'm glad I didn't know that, doctor. He recommended to my family that they watch well over me when I was surprised in this state, because he said, if you move her, you might break her, but not fix her. They had no idea what was going on. Since when I was surprised by that state, I would remain petrified. So they think that she's cooking it in her head. So a war arose on the part of the family. The poor girl, she's had wonderful isolation up until now, and now she's being watched by everybody. They prevented me from going to the church. They no longer gave me the freedom to be by myself, which would be horror for her. I was watched everywhere, and so they noticed it more often. Many times I lamented to the Lord, saying to him, "My good Jesus, how my pains have increased. I am deprived also of the things dearest to me, which are the sacraments." I'd never thought that I would reach this point, but who knows where it'll all end up? You mean in the psychiatric, you know? "Oh, please give me help and strength, for my nature is failing me." Many times he would deign to tell me a few words. He would say to me, "I am your help. What do you fear?" That is a direct quotation from Psalm 21, verse 7. "The Lord is my help. What should I fear, or whom should I fear?" And many times the scriptures are actually quoted in these writings. "Don't you remember that I too suffered from all kinds of people? Some had one opinion of me and some another." Try Mark 3:21, where the opinion they had of him wasn't wonderful and they decided to kill him. "The most holy things I did were judged by them as faulty and wicked, to the point of telling me that I was possessed. So much so that they would look at me with surly eyes." John 8:48. "You are possessed. You're a Samaritan and possessed." John 8:48. "They would keep me in their midst, but unwillingly. And they would plot among themselves how they would take my life as soon as possible." Mark 3:6. "For my presence had become intolerable to them." So, don't you want me to make you similar to me? You see, it's one thing to be like Christ, but we're thinking of being nice and all the rest. We're not thinking of going through the same trials as him. To explain, there's a wonderful scripture that explains all of what I've just read and explains it much better. And it's Wisdom chapter 2, Wisdom chapter 2, verses 10 to 20. And it says, here is this man claiming to know God and claiming to be a son of God and claiming that he has wisdom more than we have. Well, let's test him and try him and humiliate him and see how he reacts and see will God come to his help. It's very interesting. So she said, "I spent several years in this condition." One of the things that fascinates me is how long her trials go on. Like if it went on for a week or 2 weeks, that's okay. But several years suffering from creatures. Now, that's the people all around her. From demons, because the demons have been allowed to attack her, and directly from God. Oops. Job chapters 1 and 2. That's what she's experiencing, Job chapters 1 and 2. "At first I reached such bitterness from creatures and from the way that they thought, that I was ashamed of being seen by anyone." So the strange thing is that the detachment she needed in order to be 100% attentive to the Lord came about by the difficulties she was having with all the relationships. And the same thing happens to us as well, doesn't it? That it's in difficulties you actually experience that you will pull back and give yourself more to the Lord. And so that's why I call them God's little helpers. It's just that we don't feel that they're helpers. She didn't want to be seen by anyone, so much so that my greatest sacrifice was to appear in the midst of people. The blushing and confusion were such that I felt dazed. There were more visits from the doctors, but they came up with nothing. Sometimes shedding bitter tears, I would say to the Lord with all my heart, "Lord, how public my sufferings have become, not only to my family, but also to people from outside. I see myself all covered with confusion. It seems to me that everyone is pointing his finger at me as if these sufferings were the most wicked actions. I myself am unable to tell what has happened to me. Oh, please, you alone can free me from such publicity and let me suffer hiddenly. I beg you, I implore you, answer me." Sometimes the Lord, too, showed that he wouldn't listen to me and my pains would increase. He's going to let it happen until what he wants is achieved. There's a wonderful statement. I think it's in the first book of Samuel. Don't write it down because I'm not completely sure. But it says, the Lord does not thresh the corn forever. When it's ready, he's made the flour and he makes the bread and it gives life. And so, but when you're going through the trial, you feel as if it's going on forever, don't you? Yeah, and that's her problem, because she can't see outside. Spiritually, we can't see outside of a storm at all. You can only see outside of a storm if you're looking at telly, because you're looking at a storm you're not in. But he would sympathise, the word compassionate I don't use at all. He would sympathise with me, telling me, poor daughter, come to me, for I want to console you. You are right that you suffer, but don't you remember that I too, oh, how much more I suffered. Up to a certain point my pains remained hidden, she said. He said, but when the will of the Father came to me to suffer in public, promptly I went out to meet confusion, opprobrium, scorn, to the point of being stripped naked in the midst of the most numerous people. Could you imagine a confusion greater than this? My nature felt these kinds of sufferings greatly, but I had my gaze fixed on the will of the Father. Now, there's Jesus telling Louisa two things. One is, you're getting a taste of what I had in fullness. And here's the solution. I kept my attention on the will of the Father, not on the people who are causing the problem. So if you would put your full attention on the will of God, then you're going to solve this problem an awful lot quicker than you think. Because once you've solved it in your head, the amazing thing is the crisis is over. The perfect example of that, Jesus spending 3 hours agonizing in Gethsemane, to the point of pouring blood out in that terrible agony. And yet at the end of it, he said to the apostles, get up, it's all over. And as far as he was concerned, everything was over, because now he was completely fixed on the fact that I am paying this price. Everything inside of him had said his full yes, not my will, but thine. And it's only Louisa who got an insight into the struggle he had, that he couldn't take the fact that some people would go to hell even though he had paid the price for their salvation. Now, that's a problem of love. And that was what he had to say, not my will, but thine be done. And that's the theologians never worked that out. It took Louisa to get that insight. It's really, really extraordinary. But once he said his final yes, that he could pay the price for a soul and it could still go to hell. Why? Because it had free will. He wouldn't violate free will. He just fixed his eyes on the will of the Father and that was it. He could take it. And he's saying to Louisa, you'll be able to take everything that comes to you also only with your eyes fixed on the Lord. But we've known that from our charismatic renewal days and everything, all eyes on Jesus, haven't we? Yeah, absolutely. It's not the first time you hear it. But I had my gaze fixed on the will of the Father, and I offered these pains in reparation for many who commit the most wicked actions publicly, with open eyes, boasting about them without the slightest blush, saying to him, Father, accept my confusions and opprobrium in reparation for many who have the insolence to offer you so freely without to offend you so freely without the slightest sorrow. Forgive them. Give them lights that they may see the ugliness of sin and convert. I want that you too share these kinds of sufferings. Now, what Jesus has done is shown Louisa how to fix her gaze, shown her what decision to make, and shown her how to use the sufferings. Because one of the things that people have forgotten today is that everything in your life, joy and sorrow, everything, it's all treasure if only you would offer it with the corresponding thing in Jesus' life, in the divine will, for souls, because there's somebody who needs that. And sometimes, even if it's just a little moment of joy you have, somebody out there who's in despair needs that little drip of joy. It might save them from committing suicide. So don't you know that the most beautiful presents that I can give to souls I love are crosses and pains? Now, do you want to take that one out and put it on your fridge? The most beautiful presents I can give to souls I love are crosses and pains. That's why you've had suffering throughout your life. That's why you've been tripped up. That's why you've had difficulties. It's not because you're a failure or there's something extraordinarily wrong with you. And that's the mistake we can make. There's something wrong with me if all these things are happening. Instead of that, no, the Lord is trying to do something wonderful with you. If you want to become a pilot, you have to go through the training, you know. So if you want to become a saint, you need to go through the training as well. If you want to become Christ-like, then it's his training you have to go through. And then he said to her, "You are still a little girl in the way of the cross." Okay, she's only at the very beginning. "And therefore you feel weak. Once you have grown up and have known how precious suffering is," that means what you can do with it, the divine currency that it is, "then you will feel stronger. Therefore lean on me, rest, for in this way you will acquire strength." I want to give you Psalm 62 for that. You know, the psalmist says, I'm like a tumbling wall and a toppling fence, but the Lord is the strength and the Lord is the one who gives you everything that you need. So, after I spent some time in this state mentioned above, about 6 or 7 months, I always highlight the time of her trials because they're all ferociously long. "The sufferings increased to the even more to the point that I was forced to stay in bed." This is the beginning of her long sojourn in bed. "Often the state of losing consciousness multiplied to the point that I would almost not have 1 hour free." She's fully occupied. "I reduced myself to a state of extreme weakness, my mouth clenched in such a way that I couldn't open it at all. And in the few moments I would have, I was able to take just a few drops of some milk if I managed at all. And then I was forced to bring it up because of the continuous vomiting that I always had." This is the beginning of another phenomenon for her. And that is the Lord trains his victim souls either to live entirely on the Eucharist or to live on so little food that the human body won't survive. I mean, Padre Pio looked like a big man, didn't he? And yet they said he would eat enough for a bird. And he only went to the refectory to eat because he was a member of a community and out of obedience to his superiors, he would go. But he himself, his need was to live on the Eucharist. And so it was his humility and obedience that brought him to the dining room. But they said only a bird would survive on what he was actually eating. And yet, that's why I say to you, he was a big man. It's extraordinary, the way the Lord actually protected him. In Louisa's case, phenomenon begins whereby they give her food and she vomits it back. But it looks better when she vomits it back than when they gave it to her, which doesn't make sense at all. So that means the Lord is involved. And the Lord is saying to her, you actually don't need that. I will be the source of your life. And because of that, when she's not sustained by human food, then the deprivation that she experiences when the Lord doesn't come, then she literally disintegrates. And she's not exaggerating because she's only living on divine help and divine strength. So she says, "After I remained about 18 days in this continuous state," that's vomiting every day, "they called the confessor so that I could confess." I love the connection. Why would you call a confessor if someone had been vomiting for 18 days? Wouldn't you call a priest in the other sense to give you extra unction or something, or a doctor? But not a confessor, as if you were sinning. That's why this stuff needs to be really looked at. When the confessor came, he found me in that state of dozing. So she's in the ecstatic state. When I came round, he asked me what was wrong with me. And keeping silent about all the rest. Now, that's very important because Louisa has not yet opened up. And since at that time, the troubles of the demons and the visit of visits of our Lord continued, I just said to him, Father, it's the devil. Now, you wouldn't get away with that with most priests that I know, or I think 100% of priests that I know. He said to me, do not be afraid, for it's not the devil. And if it is he, Father will free you. So, giving me the obedience and marking me with the sign of the cross and helping me to loosen my arms, for I felt my whole body petrified as if it had become one single piece, he managed to restore the motion of my arms. This is the beginning of a phenomenon that's going to kill her in very real sense. And to make me open my mouth, which before had been unmovable to everything. I attributed this to the sanctity of my confessor, who was really a holy priest. I considered this almost a miracle, so much so that I would say to myself, see, I was ready to die, because I really felt ill. And if that state had continued, I think I would have left life. Poor girl has no idea, she's got 64 more years to go. However, I remembered that I was resigned, and when I saw myself free, I felt a certain regret that I didn't die. That's 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10. Now, for those of you for whom this text is new, I know it's not new to a number of you, what's going to happen now is that quite frequently she will go into this ecstatic state and she will be, as she says herself, petrified. She won't be able to move. And a mere blessing from the priest is going to free her. And you have to ask yourself, what is going on? Why couldn't anybody else free her? It was the Lord's way of trying to get the church involved. The church wouldn't get involved. No, nobody knows what's really going on for Louisa at this particular point. And the Lord is going to insist that a priest does it, a priest does it, a priest does it, a priest. And eventually poor Louisa will say, but Lord, can't you do it or somebody else do it? Why did the priest have to come? And he said, I had a priest assist me as well on Calvary. That was John. Yeah. And she's going to find that difficult initially. But this is the beginning of it. You see, in this volume now, you're getting the beginnings of everything. And it's fascinating. Now, the priest doesn't know that the Lord is going to use this pretext to make sure that he comes every single day. And it's only as he comes every single day he begins to realise, hey, what's going on here is phenomenal. We're going to have to get this woman to talk. And by the time they get Louisa to talk, she has made incredible progress spiritually. Absolutely incredible. And the priests are so astonished they can't believe it. And that's the Lord making the church get involved. Because what he's going to do with Louisa is not just make her a saint personally, but he's going to make a major revelation to the church about the divine will. Louisa doesn't know that in volume one. Naturally enough, the church doesn't know it. So only the Lord can make the church have to be involved. So it's only the ministry of the priest that can set her free. I find it fascinating. I think it's a good place to stop for tonight and we can have a little discussion.